this too loud? Seems loud there. It's okay. For the tape people, we're starting. My name is Dan Erlander, and I'm part of the staff here at Holden Village, working on the Resource Center. And I'm now about to give my first keynote address in my life on St. Francis. I want to read, this is from Article 21 of the Augsburg Confession. This is a statement that the early Lutherans gave to the Roman Catholic Church, explaining the position of Lutherans. It is also taught among us that saints should be kept in remembrance so that our faith may be strengthened when we see what grace they received and how they were sustained by faith. Moreover, their good works are to be an example for us, each of us in his or her own calling. With this background, we look now at the life of St. Francis, and you might want to follow as I speak on the kind of time chart. Does everybody have one of these? And then, if you don't, just raise your hand and we'll give you one. Do you need an extra? I want to say a word about my background in St. Francis. Until just the last several weeks, it's been more of a feeling or more of just a sense of St. Francis. A lot of that sense came from living in New Mexico for 6.5 years. And some call New Mexico in its Spanish tradition that goes back hundreds of years as the land of St. Francis. The Franciscans that came, the early Spanish settlers, to them, Francis was the most beloved saint. So all over the state are pictures of St. Francis, statues of St. Francis. The cathedral of the Archdiocese is the Cathedral of St. Francis. And the Spanish woodcarvers in the mountains for generations have been carving out of the cottonwood the statue of St. Francis. And one of our memories of living in New Mexico is this very primitive, I think, folk wood carving. George Lopez is like 78 years old, has his carvings in the Smithsonian under American folk craft. And these people sit and whittle away, and I think to them, St. Francis is their most beloved saint. In a way, Francis sustained these settlers in the early years. And then Francis was brought to the Pueblo Indians by the early Franciscan missionaries. So there was a sense of St. Francis, but it wasn't until the last several weeks until I started kind of pulling together what his life really is. And that's what I'd like to share now as the beginning of this day of celebration of the life of this person. I'm getting to like him more all the time. And I hope I can share some of that joy and enthusiasm. But when we look at the Bible, we always begin by looking at, the historical setting. And for the life of Francis, it's very important to see what was happening in the world and his world at that time. And I like to start by showing how this was a time of tremendous social upheaval. Up until this, near the time of St. Francis, and just as a key date, remember, this year we celebrate the 800th, so when we talk about the birth of St. Francis, we're talking about 1182. And then most of the work of St. Francis in the early part of the 13th century. Now, up until this time, life had been very organized and neatly organized in what we learned in school as a feudal system. And there were really, you were either one or the other, and if you were born one, that was you for your life. And you would have never questioned or even thought of moving into another class. And that was you were either a majoris or a minoris. And that just simply means big people and little people. And this was a feudal system. This was the nobles, the knights, and the lords. And then over here you had the majority were the serfs, the farm workers. And then also another class, the minoris, were the I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Villeins, and they were two types, the craft people and the merchants. The serfs were practically slaves. These people had a little more freedom, but also because of heavy taxation and forced labor, they actually had very little freedom. Now the Crusades, and this is the age of the Crusades, the Christian armies sweeping over the what was called the Holy Land to try to regain the holy places for Christianity. And of course it was the knights that went to fight the battles of the Crusades, but along with them came the merchant people, who again were part of the menorahs, and because of the new trade that was opened up because of the Crusades, many of these merchants became so wealthy that sometimes money equals power. I don't know if you ever knew that. Sometimes money equals power. And they began to accumulate so much money that eventually they could threaten or start assuming some of the power that had at one time been completely in the hands of the nobles. Now, how this worked kind of geographically is the merchants would take over a city and eventually take political control of that city, drive the nobility away from the power in that city, and then form their own political entity. And then they would actually have the wealth and the power. Now, Assisi, where Francis is now one of these towns, and they're called communes. And then, not sure that's spelled right, so I'll just erase it. They're called communes. And what the situation now is, you have the merchants running the commune, the nobility, at least for that area, having lost power. Now, what about the serfs and maybe also the craft people? They gained nothing from this great social upheaval. Now, in fact, their plight was worse, because at least in the old system, there was a strict protection of the serfs, even if they were practically slaves. But now what you had in these new little towns and cities that were run by the merchants is you'd have the wealthy, and really we'd call them the new rich. And you have to understand what new rich means to kind of understand these people. In Albuquerque, a few blocks from our house, we had a new home built by a new rich, a contractor that made it. And this has nothing to do with St. Francis, but it's funny. But we used to ride our bicycles over there and look at this massive home that everybody thought was an apartment building. Rising, and we finally figured out the setting that in this home, and of course it was French provincial, and which really fits into the New Mexico scene. And you walk into this massive door that had the place where the chauffeur drives up, you know, the U-shaped. Then when you walked into this massive double door, instead of walking into an entryway, you walk into this massive indoor heated swimming pool over on this side, so the person immediately walking in can see, my, this person has made it. And right next to the swimming pool is this stairway that you see in the movies, you know, this great big round stairway. Well, the point was, new rich, it was very important, I guess, for them to show their wealth. We'll hold that a minute and we'll get to that. But now when we talk about merchants, we're talking about the new rich in that age. And then around the border of the city then would be all of the poor people who now did not even have the protection they had under the old feudal system, but they were just simply totally exploited. And you saw that a little in the movie last night. When there was work that needed to be done, they did it without any rights. But many, many were unemployed, and once you were too old to work, you were simply sent away with no benefits and no security. So around the towns then, you just had many, many unemployed people who their only hope of survival was being beggars. And then the other thing that these people were used for, if you have one city here, then another city over here, and another city over here, then there was competition for trade routes, for tolls on trade routes and everything. So you had something called war. And they loved war. It was fun because you could really dress up for a war. And you saw that in the movie. And the merchants now could, they had enough power that they actually could become knights. And this was fantastic. You could get your own armor and horse and all that stuff and be a knight. And what happened if you were a knight in these battles now between different communes or towns is that the poor people on the outskirts of the city, they went ahead of you to fight the war, and then you stayed behind on your horses and held your flags and banners and everything, and then they would either win or lose. If they won, then you would go back to town and you would be treated as a great victor. And then if you lost, as St. Francis Assisi did, Francis then ended up as a prisoner of war for a while. But they loved war. And they would develop hatred for each other. And before a battle, they would dress up as caricatures of the people in the next town that they were going to fight. And so they would dehumanize them and call them animals and dress up as animals and pretend like they were the enemy. So war was fun. And the people that got killed in the war were the poor people anyway. So this is the setting now. And now notice St. Francis' father now is this new merchant class or the new rich. I'm going to move to the importance of clothing, because the title of this keynote address is St. Francis, the History's Greatest Threat to the Clothing Industry. Quote from one of the biographers, "It was the custom then to advertise one's wealth by one's clothing and clothing, and luxury was, for the most part, confined to dress." It's kind of the single way to show that you had made it was the way you dressed. And the fancier you dress, the more you said you had made it. Men vied with one another in wearing the richest and most showy textures. Okay, now get an idea. If this is the way you show your wealth, could there be a better time to be in the clothing and cloth industry? And that's what Francis' father is in. Yeah. Now, the clothing as a status symbol is never a problem in our age, right? And I even have the Penny's cool brand. It's called the 1901. It's right here on my show. Isn't it amazing how this never changed? Designer jeans, how your shirt immediately is more status if it has an alligator. Now this gives us a little idea, but at that time it was much more, because clothing was almost the one way to show who you were in the society. And so Francis grew up in a world where he probably was the most glamorous young man in town. And of course he would be, because his father was the most successful clothing merchant. Okay, another part of the world is that it was also, as you know, and we'll see today in our parade, I would think, and everything, a world of knights and chivalry. It was also a world where the church was at the very pinnacle of papal power. That was an alliteration I thought of by accident. It just came out. But no time in history now had the church more political power in the world. Not only did the Pope have a kingdom or really a nation in Italy of his own, but also the Pope had armies, and the Pope had so much power that the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire was really appointed, chosen by the Pope. And the Pope at this time had enough power to dispose of any ruler of all the different European political entities. So when Francis went to Innocent III, he went to probably the most powerful Pope in the history, or in all of the history of what we call Christendom. And it was also a corrupt church. The movie brought that out a little. But if the movie was exaggerating and kind of maybe the costumes and everything, it wasn't exaggerating in the fact that it was a time of spiritual death in the Christian church, but also a time of tremendous corruption, where every bishop and cardinal was just another political entity with his own armies and soldiers. If we talk about the theology of glory, maybe this was where maybe the theology of glory has reached its most gross proportions. Because of this, there were a lot of little reform movements going on in the church, but most of them were rebellious against the church, and naturally the Pope was anxious to stomp everyone out. And it gives you an idea why it was so important for Francis to go to Rome to receive the approval of the Pope for his order. Well, that's a little of the background now of the world into which St. Francis is born. Francis, born in 1182, was first named Clovani. And then his father had been in France, and in honor of France, when father got home, he changed the name to Francisco. And this is okay, because if you're from San Francisco, it sounds better than... What if they ask you where you're from and you said St. Clovani, California? It just doesn't ring. But he was renamed, and I think we pointed out already that one characteristic of Francis from his early days, and then I'm going to point out another, but one was extravagance. We've all had friends that we say, oh, he goes overboard at everything he does, or she just cannot stop, she just carries it all the way. We have the word prodigal for that. The prodigal, just meaning always extravagant in the proportions to which one carries something. And then the other characteristic that Francis had very early was a sense of destiny. We're a little uncomfortable with this, but it was part of his early life that he really believed that someday he would be world famous. And the way he first tried to gain that fame was through military. And when he decided to become a knight, the story is that he out-knighted every knight in just the sheer weight and glamour of his armor as he rode out of Assisi, just wooing everyone with the most expensive armor that a knight. And he really went out to seek what every knight would seek, and that is glory. And he really felt he had a destiny to be world famous as a knight. He also had a problem being a knight. He had a certain personality characteristic that went against what he was trying to do. Because the minute he got out of town and saw somebody that didn't have enough, good enough armor, he gave his away. You know, and this was his fatal flaw already showing. But then we won't dwell on the story of how, as a knight, he went to battle. He was a prisoner of war, was very sick, and in the opening part of the movie, he was sick at home. And through his sickness, gradually another self, his being a knight really wasn't really Francis. And what he really was started to show itself in love of nature and love of people. He also, in the movie, did not bring this out, that he was the party person of Assisi. And as I pointed out last night, not only did he use his father's money, and his father didn't mind this too much, that he used his father's money to throw the wildest and the grandest parties in Assisi. And the reports, as you read in his biographers, was that not only he threw the parties, but he was also the chief entertainer and clown. That you have a sense that Francis had the personality that if he were in an American high school would be Mr. What do we call them? We elect them Mr. Personality. You know, the one that's always funny, always is keeping everybody laughing, and is playing a guitar and always singing, and at the party is the life of the party. And is very endearing and also very disarming. If you put all of these together, you have a very unique personality of a person that goes all the way with everything he does, and while he's doing it, everybody loves it and loves him. you know, picture maybe the one person you've met in your life who is like this, or somewhat like this, and you start to put together the personality of Francis. He hated lepers in his growing up. I mean, this nothing nauseated him more than to see a leper. And later in his life, he wrote, so this isn't legend, but he wrote this was the most significant change that happened, was walking down the road one day, meeting a leper, and all of a sudden he changed, and he ran up, threw his arms around the leper, and kissed him. And then from that leper, ran to the leprosarium, ran into the place, and imagine this leprosarium where every day is the same. You get up, you suffer, and you go to bed, and you go to sleep, and you get up the next morning and suffer. But one day, the son of the wealthy cloth merchant runs into the leprosarium, falls on his knees before everyone, and begs forgiveness. You know, this is not the normal day in the leprosarium. And then every leper kisses on the lips. And now society, as much as in Bible times, the society made lepers untouchables. Untouchables. He kisses everyone on the lips. Now from this, Francis is still at home. And he develops, this was more of a quiet thing than was in the movie last night, but he develops what's called the law of reciprocal containers. It simply means find it where it is and put it where it isn't. Do you get it? So where it is in his father's cloth house, where it isn't is all the poor people that surround the city of Assisi. So he just every day finds more need and more need and more people that don't have enough and more people who are hungry. So he simply sells another bowl of cloth, takes the money out and feeds somebody, helps somebody, comforts somebody, gives it away, gives away clothes. And father is saying, well, this was okay when it was for parties, but this is absurd. So then father takes son to the court, which was the bishop. And there, Francis declares that God is now his father. His father is no longer his father. And as a symbolic gesture, takes off his clothes and gives them to his father. And says, everything that you have given me, I now give back. And now this symbolic gesture has a tremendous history and a tremendous biblical meaning. Some say Francis completely nude. Obviously, the producer followed that line. Others say he left on his shorts. But what Francis was saying is, now remember, clothing is the most important thing in the world for your status. And he's really saying, I'm dying. I'm being crucified. And early Christians, and some of you will know I would get third century baptism into this some way, but early Christians, before they went into the waters of baptism, took all of their clothes off, and they left them on the west side of the font. And the symbolism was, I leave everything behind in my old life as I go into the water of baptism. And then when they came out of the water, a new robe, a new garment. And to the early Christians, and I wouldn't be surprised if it meant much the same to Francis, to the early Christian, it meant two things. First of all, it meant when I go into the water of baptism, I'm crucified with Christ, and Christ went to the cross with nothing. You were crucified with nothing, no clothes on. That was part of the total humiliation of crucifixion. And the other was to take off the clothes and put on new was the symbol of a total new life and a death to an old life. And in that square before the church, before the Bishop of Assisi, Francis died to an old way of life and embraced a new way of life. It was a new birth. It was, as he finally said, it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Now I'm going to make an assignment for each of your minds and kind of play this scenario, I guess I'll call it, in your own mind. This is my mind, and I'm assuming it is most of our minds, that to a certain extent, we think of life, of course, as many other things, but we also think of life in terms of somehow you move upward in life as you kind of gain more stuff. Now, remember your student days, if you were a student once and you were kind of poor and you lived in that little apartment next to the university or something, or maybe when you were first starting a home, it was that little home, and then it's the bigger home, and then it's the bigger home, and then it's the room addition. Or we measure our lives sometimes in terms of our cars, you know, the old Ford. Then it was the Buick years, you know, then it was the years of this car. And then we think now, we do our future planning in terms of, okay, when is the year of the new refrigerator? You know, when is the year of the microwave? Then it's the year of the computer and the home computer. Then we move up and up and up and up. And this, in a way, although life is other things, we think of success in life as this, and then going backwards in life would be if you would go back to that little student apartment. That would be going backwards. Now take this in your mind, and we all have it to a certain extent, and just kind of totally turn it around, and now you have the mind of St. Francis after his death in the courtyard before the church in Assisi. And this is going to sound crazy, to Francis's mind now, the biggest fear in his life is that he might get something. Okay, and total success in the life is to have absolutely nothing. And then when he gets something, the important thing is to allow not more than 2 or 3 seconds before I get rid of this, because that is failure. Are you starting to see? And the vision of life is to finally reach that point of nothing. I don't know, does this go contrary to any of our American values? Or Canadian values? United States, Canadian, or Western, North American values. Switch it all around and think of yourself instead of having this fear, my goodness, what if the house burned down? Start thinking, my goodness, what if the house doesn't burn down? Okay, now where did Francis get this strange idea? And now I wanted you to start thinking, because this is where I think the real difference between the main point of the movie and what I see is the life of St. Francis is the way of the cross. I think Francis moved to his love of nature from this, but just hold that for a minute. Now, what kind of dress then does Francis adopt? The shabby tunic of a beggar or the poor working class is held together by a rope. Then also during this time he had received the church, you know, that was falling apart. There actually was a church that was falling apart. And he looked at the crucifix in the old church and heard the voice, and the voice said, restore my house, which as you see is going to ruin. Now we would say, well, probably the house meant the whole Christian church on earth, which was literally falling apart as a spiritual body. But Francis' immediate reaction was it meant getting this church building back in repair. And before his experience at before the bishop, he sold bolts of cloth from his father's house to buy stones to carry out there to build this building. And so now, after his what we would call conversion, Francis continues to build the church building and also begins now to gather friends around him who also adopt his way of life. And they become orderlies at the leprosarium. Imagine all the fun the lepers are having. because Francis and his companions are truly happy. I mean, the report says they just walked all around just laughing and singing and giggling and giggled their way right into the leprosarium and spent all day just helping them around, cleaning, bathing, doing the exact thing that society said is unthinkable. Then in 1208 is when Francis heard the text read at Mass from Matthew 10, the words of Jesus to the disciples to go out and preach the gospel with nothing. And that's now when Francis has a vision of his mission in life is just to go around with his friends preaching the gospel that the kingdom of God is here, and to do that caring nothing and being just dependent on those to whom you preach to supply your needs. So he goes about, and he pulls the clothing act again, and he likes to preach in Assisi in his underwear. You have to think of Francis now as to the ordinary citizen. Their first response was, this son of the cloth merchant has just gone bananas. And if this happened in our day, in our town, in our church, we would say the same thing. He's gone bananas. But up and down the streets preaching, conflict comes, so Francis then goes to Rome to confront Innocent III. And again, remember that Innocent III is maybe the most powerful pope in the history of Christendom. His one agenda is to have the order of now his brotherhood approved. And the main point of the order is that the individual monk will have absolutely nothing, and the order will have absolutely nothing. I explained a little in Vespers last night how it came about, how Francis really had three meetings with Innocent, largely through the intercession of a friend who had a way into the Pope. And on the third meeting, the Pope approved the order of the Friars Minor, or the Little Brothers. And part of it, I don't know if this is legend or what we would call reality, but the Pope had a dream, and in this dream he saw the whole church falling over, this tremendous building falling over, and this little monk holding it up. If that was a dream, it was somewhat persuasive. But the most persuasive was the cardinal, who said to the Pope, if we turn down the request of St. Francis, we are saying and admitting that the gospel cannot be lived in this world. There's something about this so powerful to me because all of those church leaders and the Pope and all of their power and glory and worldly might had a sense of honesty that they were not living the gospel when they saw Francis coming in his rags. And the final approval of the order came with the argument that if we do not approve the order, we're really saying the gospel cannot be lived.
Young. Did Francis become a priest at that point?
Now, Francis never became a priest. He was a lay person all his life. So that should be some comfort to I think it's real affirmation of the laity. And he very intentionally never wanted to be a priest.
And are all the monks not priests?
No, there were some priests in the brotherhood. Mm-hmm.
So this young woman he became interested in, is that Claire?
Mm-hmm. Right. I think the movie was somewhat inaccurate that she followed them around. She very soon gathered her friends around and the sisters of, or the poor Clares, and they each had their own group and lived separately, although there was real fellowship between them. And the movie also didn't bring out that there was much more struggle of Claire leaving her family than there was for Francis. They sent practically an army to capture her to bring her back. But when she was in the church with her hair cut off, because of the sense of honor that day, they could not touch her then. In a way, at that point, she had crossed over where they could not But the movie was right in terms of Claire being, you know, the deep, deep friend of Francis for his whole life and was with Claire at his death. And I think we should have a Claire Day sometime. Yeah, there's, it's continued to this day. Poor Claire's. Mm-hmm. Then, okay, now I want to, when Francis returned from Rome, it was really kind of the Camelot days now of the Franciscan order with just a few brothers. They lived in a hut and they simply had fun living in the woods and just enjoying what they would call, or I think we would call, freedom in Christ. And it just meant going around having fun begging, having fun helping, having fun going to the leprosarium, and having fun laughing and joking together. It was the days of wonder. It was the days of beauty for this order. And one concept that Francis had with the early days of this order, in fact, all his life, was that he was deeply in love with his lady. And he borrowed the symbolism from chivalry. Every knight has a lady, and Francis's lady is Lady Poverty. And now to understand Francis is to start understanding the personality of this almost mythical creature called Lady Poverty. Lady Poverty was present in the garden. Okay, now I'll back up a little. To understand Lady Poverty, we have to understand what Francis meant by poverty. Francis did not mean by poverty total, I can't think of the word, being totally destitute. In other words, being so hungry and starving that you are living in a way where you are just, where your life is just totally, you know, as would be in third world countries today, and where children are dying of starvation. Now that is not what Francis meant by poverty. By poverty, Francis meant this. It means to have absolutely nothing except a daily trust in God to provide one's needs. To have nothing for the next day, but only each day God will provide the needs. It's a life of total risk, and it's a life of total trust, faith, and dependency on the mercy of God and the providence of God for each day's needs. Francis, that is poverty. And Lady Poverty is in love where a person follows this way of life. The one time where Lady Poverty had a true lover was in the Garden of Eden, before Adam and Eve put their clothes on, again, clothes. Because before, in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve lived in poverty, meaning they lived each day totally trusting and in risk, depending on the providence of God to meet their needs. And after the fall is when people started saying, my goodness, we cannot trust God. We're going to have to accumulate for ourselves and gather possessions for tomorrow. So all through the ages, then Lady Poverty just wandered around the earth with no lover until Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and Lady Poverty found her lover again at the manger, as God is incarnated in total nothingness, and as Jesus, the incarnation of God, lives with no place to lay his head, but depending each day on the mercy of God to supply his needs. Again, Lady Poverty has a lover. Also, Lady Poverty had a lover in the apostles who first went out to preach with nothing. As Jesus said, go out with nothing, not even a purse. Just go out and preach the gospel. And Lady Poverty was happy again. But soon the church started accumulating again and saying, we can't trust God to provide our daily needs. We'll have to start accumulating so we have security. And so Lady Poverty starts wandering around the earth now without anybody that is her lover. And this might seem a little arrogant to us, but the early Franciscans in their little joyful community saw themselves as, again, the home where we can open the door and Lady Poverty comes in. And I want to read Page 74 and 75. This is, now their little hut, and this is when they're preparing for Lady Poverty to come. So long as the blood of the crucified poor man was fresh in their memory and the chalice of his passion inebriated their heart, Christians practiced poverty. I forgot to point out that where Lady Poverty was closest to a lover was on the cross, because the cross was the ultimate of risking vulnerable, total dependence on the mercy of God to vindicate. So nowhere in history had Lady Poverty been more at home than, and Francis had this picture that as Jesus was crucified, that Lady Poverty was right there with him on the cross. Christians practiced poverty, but then came peace, which for me was worse than war and renewed my sufferings. This is Lady Poverty speaking. Once more, all forsook me, including those so-called religious who had promised me to be faithful. How many are there among them who in the world, living poor, hungry, and lean, lacking even lowly bread and lodging neath the sweet briar, and who once united me have grown fat in their cloisters, have sought to appear great in man's eyes, and have come and spat in my face? Now, these complaints bring tears to the eyes of Francis and his followers, who swear eternal fidelity to the forlorn and lovely lady. She consents to follow them to their hermitage. And now the picture is their nervousness. Will she feel at home with us? Okay, now Lady Poverty arrives. Let me first visit, she says upon arrival, your cloister, your refectory, your kitchen, your dormitory, your stables, your fine furniture and magnificent establishment, for thus far I have seen only your radiant and friendly faces. Dear lady and queen, they replied, your servants are weary from our journey and you too much tired, so with your kind permission we will begin to dine. When we shall have recovered somewhat, we shall carry out your wishes. Gladly, but I must first wash my hands. They went and fetched, for want of better, a chipped earthen pot filled with water. She asked for a towel. But when they did not find any, one of the friars offered his tunic instead. They then led the princess to the table, in other words, before a few pieces of barley bread spread out on the grass. Everyone sat down on the ground, and after giving thanks to God, the Lady Poverty pretended to wait for cooked food to be served up on plates. But only a bowl of fresh water was brought in which everyone dipped his crust. Well, don't you have some fresh vegetables to top off our menu, she inquired. The brothers excused themselves for having neither a gardener nor a garden, and then went off to gather some wild fruits and herbs in the forest. But don't you have at least a little salt to season these bitter herbs? Lady, they replied, we should have to go to the city to get some. Well, then salt is not necessary. Please pass me a knife to cut this bread with, for it is really quite dry. Alas, dear lady, we have no maker of knives on hand. Meanwhile, we pray you to use your teeth. Well, will you not let me taste of your wine, she asked. Oh, queen, we never use it, and it seems to us that Christ's spouse as well ought to shun wine like poison. Well, after they were thus satisfied, all rose and joyously intoned their thanks anew. As the Lady Poverty expressed the desire to rest a few moments, they showed her the bare ground. When she asked for a pillow, they slipped a stone under her head, then withdrew so she could sleep. When she awoke, the fancy took her to visit their cloister. So they led her up a hill and, pointing to the horizon with a sweeping gesture, as if the whole world were theirs, their lady is our cloister. The fair visitor declared herself perfectly satisfied. Truly today I believed myself in paradise, she said. And after another long discourse, she took leave of them. Now I could at this point go into all different things in the life of Francis, and we don't have time. When does this end? 5 minutes? Threatening. We could go into Francis' preaching, his singing, his missionary journeys, his going to Egypt to try to straighten out the Crusades, his being disgusted with the brutality of the Christian armies, his attempt to solve the problem of the Crusades by converting the Muslim Sultan to Christianity, the Sultan's really love of Francis. But I'd like to just mention in closing, got too much left here, but Francis' sense of the love of nature. He had two lovers, Lady Poverty and Mother Earth. And often we think of them as two different things, but and the movie especially made the love of nature seem to come first, but to understand Francis' connection with nature, you must first understand Lady Poverty. Okay, once one lives a life of total dependency upon God to meet the needs of life each day, then one learns one's connectedness to nature. Because when I am simply receiving daily what nature has to provide, all of a sudden I see myself as standing alongside every bird, every animal, every flower, every tree, even the sun, moon, and stars, as all meet each other's needs. And the Heavenly Father provides each one's needs. So it's only by seeing Francis' poverty do we move from there to a sense of being connected to all of nature. And you'll never understand by just being an ecologist, Francis, you must first understand his sense of poverty. And at that point of poverty, he sees how he's part of all of nature and then can call every part of nature brother or sister. Out of that love of nature, he centered it around a word called cortesia. And cortesia, the translation would be courtesy, but it's the way I live when I sense my connectedness. So I treat every part of nature and every human being I meet with cortesia, meaning the manners and the courtesy and the sensitivity of another being that is also dependent, also in poverty, before the God who supplies all of the needs. And now I want to just close with what we would call the crucifixion of Francis. Maybe no one has more patterned life after the life of Christ, some would say, than Francis. We think of his brotherhood now as reaching thousands of followers. Every year they have a Pentecost meeting in a field and they have no committees. They just all get together and figure somebody will bring the food. No committees. But gradually there's a movement among the Francis' order called reality. And these are the people that say utter poverty is unrealistic. And they finally gain power in the movement and they say, at least we got to have a monastery with some dishes. And Francis says, no. We live in total dependency each day upon God. The realists, and in a way probably the realists always win. And finally, on a Pentecost meeting, Francis gives up the leadership and the order and turns it over to Brother Ilias, who is the one who says we have to live realistically in this world. Francis, in depression and despair, goes off to a hill to pray in solitude. And there he weeps. But there he discovers finally his crucifixion, that to be crucified is to give up everything. And he had one thing left, and that was the brotherhood. And now that was gone. And all he had left now was Christ. And there Francis died, because there Francis gave everything away, including his followers. And it was this point in his life, and I don't think the stigmata is a legend, that Francis so identified with the total giving up of everything of Jesus on the cross. We would call it psychosomatic today, that the wounds of Christ actually appeared on the hands and the feet of Francis. And it was not a glorious martyr type of thing to have those wounds. The last years, the report is that they were extremely painful, throbbing with pain. Francis here gave up everything. And his last days, I was going to mention one other thing, and the time is running out, and I'm frightened. It was also out of this time of prayer and discouragement that he emerged to build the world's first Christmas creche, and called the town of Assisi to see, and had a priest celebrate the Eucharist, and set up a little creche, put animals around it. And the report of that night is that Francis was in just ecstatic joy. And he read the lessons, and he said he was so in love with Jesus, when the word Jesus came up in the Bible, he wouldn't let it out of his mouth. Would just hang on to that. I suppose we call it the stained glass tone. He wouldn't let that word go because he loved Jesus so much. And why? Because in the manger he saw again God embracing Lady Poverty. Well, the last days, Francis is sick, eyesight worsening, pain, but joy, and it is this time he writes the beautiful canticle of Brother Son, sings it every day, writes the other verses as he heals a breach between the bishop and the mayor of Assisi, and then on his deathbed writes the final verse about embracing death. And then he dies with Claire with him, his closest brothers who were with him from the beginning. And before his death, he asked to be put, to have all of his clothes removed again, and to be placed on the earth. And Francis dies in a way then with Lady Poverty holding one hand and Mother Earth holding the other. And now tonight we're going to in our next sessions now we'll talk about the meaning of Francis, and then tonight in our forum try to pull together what this all means. And to me it means much. That's all I'll say now.